Okay, we are live from Hong Kong. We're in the Mum's Not Home
That's right,
Cafe here in Hong
yes.
Kong, which is a very cool cafe, and I'm here with Anson Chum. Welcome, Anson.
Thank you, Harry, for taking this opportunity for me to talk.
Anson Chum is an entrepreneurial marketer with over 15 years' experience across a number of industries, including sustainability, luxury goods, fashion retail, travel, and lifestyle. After graduating in fashion design from Central Saint Martins University of the Arts, Anson spent the next 12 years working his way up the luxury fashion industry. Worked his way up in the luxury fashion industry from sales assistant to visual merchandiser. He eventually worked for Hugo Boss as a visual merchandiser before becoming a PR agent for Bluebell Group, Jimmy Choo, and Davidoff, as well as Moschino and Paul Smith. In 2016, Anson founded Ucon, which is known for their signature curved carry-on luggage designs. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's before curve is there was a round one, a circle one as well. Yeah, so
So you guys pretty much did you pioneer that shape, would you say?
yes, we did. We actually applied for patent.
Oh, you patented it? Okay, cool. Thinking outside the box, pun intended. And which quickly attained global success and was one of the few brands from Hong Kong that was stocked on Net-a-Porter, Matches Fashion, Studio Concrete, and it's appeared in Vogue and New York Times. And in this episode, we're going to find out about the story behind Anson's entrepreneurial and design expertise, how he navigated the luxury fashion industry, what it's like being a PR for some of the world's biggest luxury brands, and more. So, hope you enjoy. So, I want to start at the beginning of you kind of growing up. Were you a creative child and that sort of thing? Like, what do you think sparked your interest of this entrepreneurial and design journey?
As a young kid, I remember I always enjoy painting and drawing. I mean, I without knowing so much about my future career, all I know was that I appreciate beautiful things. Not only by appreciating, but I like to draw them. So my objects for drawings are usually human, faces as well. So my sisters, I have three sisters, and two of them really obsessed with fashion. So I would come home and see many fashion magazines on their table. Then sometime I would pick a few and draw the cover girl. And I think that was my first encounter with art and design, because I remember keep on drawing without feeling bored about it, and I can just, find the nicest cover and go on and on for days. And later on, I was asked to enter some competitions by relatives and friends, and of course they didn't want to let their school knows that it's not from them but from someone else. So but I was happy to help out, and for me it's just another piece of drawing, right? So I submitted a few and it won some prize, and and that was how I knew that actually there could be a challenge for me to pursue in this what we call like a hobby, I
Yeah,
think.
yeah. And then as a teenager, were you, how did you kind of take that drawing and painting to the next level? Was there anything else that you were making or business-wise that you might have been doing? Or?
I was very simple-minded. I didn't really think that far. I mean, for me, it's like I just keep on doing something that I enjoy. That's all. And certainly I wasn't thinking about building a career out of it. But what I knew was that I was never satisfied with drawing the same person again and again. I always trying to make something different each time. So either by using a different color tone or a different technique, I would always try to experiment and try something new that I have not tried previously. And maybe that's how you call, you know, like reinventing yourself.
Yeah. Okay. And then you, what were you kind of pursuing at high school? Was it the arts, or did they have the arts program here in Hong Kong? Or?
The arts. I'm not like a typical Chinese kid. I was not interested in mathematics at all. Mm. So for me, anything to do with art and design was more my thing. Mm. So when I was given the choice to choose what type of designs I want to do, I remember there was interior design, fashion design, and one more, graphic design.
Mm-hmm. Is this at high school?
In high school.
Okay.
But as you can understand, that my object of obsessions is always with human faces and bodies. So it was quite naturally for me to pick fashion design, because that's the it's the type of design that you will always have to reference to a person.
Yeah.
Whereas for interior design, it has a lot to do with body and space, but in a more abstract form in a way. So fashion design is more direct. So maybe that was why I picked fashion at first.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that you said that interior design and graphic design and what was the other one?
Fashion design.
Fashion design. Yeah. That was available in high school.
Yeah, already.
Wow, that's, I don't know of any other place in the world those courses, like in Australia, it's definitely not. I mean, we have like an arts program, but it's just kind of like art history, and I think we have a photography, but not interior design. And
Of course, it was not in the sense that it got very specialized in one thing, but they kind of, I think the school, they wanted to give you a perspective of all the different type of designs.
Yeah.
And so that when you go to college later on, or university later on, you are more certain about the choice you made. I think that was the intention.
Okay.
Yeah, but there was not an examination for you to test your skills and your professional chosen field. It's not like that. But then it was more like a brief selection, you know, of the interests for a specific area, that's all.
Okay. And from that, did you go straight to Central St. Martin's in London?
Yes, it was actually my decision to go to UK.
You make that decision?
Yeah, well, of course, I had to convince my parents to give me the money.
Okay.
To do it, because you're talking about it's quite a large sum that you're talking about for overseas students coming from Hong Kong to UK. We are talking about roughly like £30,000 per year, including living and the fee for the school.
Wow.
So it was not an easy decision for me as well as for my parents, because there would always, obviously, there were additional financial burden on their side.
Yeah.
But then after trying, you know, for months, and they let me go.
Okay.
So I actually secretly filled in all the application without telling them, and then eventually there was an offer coming from the university. That was when I told them, because I wanted to prove that I could make it happen first before I break out the news, you know.
Okay. Yeah. It's interesting because just from talking to Grace first, but then shout out to Grace for setting this interview up as well. She studied at Central Saint Martin's.
Yes.
And then I interviewed a designer in Japan, Jude Ferrari, and she has her label Maison J. Simone, which is a French brand, and she studied at Central Saint Martin's. Also, Grace's friend Dreyfus studied at Central Saint Martin's. So there's something about this university that is interesting. I think it seems to be a very good one for creative people.
Well, there were actually two choices I was given, you know, when I thought about going to university art college in the UK. There was either one called London College of Fashion or Central Saint Martin. Of course, most people know about Central Saint Martin, but what they didn't know is that the teaching techniques are actually very different between the two colleges. So London College of Fashion is focusing on more technical aspects of the business, mm-hmm. whereas Central Saint Martin's is more, it has more an artistic approach.
With
so
history.
They, yeah, not so much with history. Oh yeah, it has a, you know, like a very renowned history in fashion design, but then in terms of the teaching itself, mm-hmm. they pretty much, there is no brief. They pretty much throw their students out there to do whatever they want. For me, as an Asian student, it was kind of hard in the beginning because we always
have structure.
Yes. And there is always a brief to tell you exactly how you get to where you want to go. And for my 3 years experience in St. Martin, it was an eye-opener because there was no brief. Except that you have to come back every 3 months to submit your final project or a presentation. But that was kind of scary for me because you're judged by, you know, the entire panel to criticize your work, and you know, sometimes the comments are not always pleasing.
Yeah.
I've seen cases where they, you know, like said something really rude to the students.
So is that how, so you studied fashion design and maybe you'd have like you'd make like a collection or something like that?
A portfolio
and then you'd show like a panel, is it?
It was not like that actually. It was, to me, it was much more difficult than I thought. So I was given an appointment to meet with the person who assess all the portfolios. I mean, that's only the first thing. And they told me straight I was not good enough. Perhaps you'll never be. But try to prove yourself within a week. We're going to send someone to come and look at your work again.
Yeah.
But by looking at what you are showing us, I can tell you no already. So try to come up with a collection of 8 pieces within 6 days. I was thinking, what? I mean, I do know a little bit about fashion designs back then, but I didn't know how to sew.
Yeah.
And I definitely didn't know how to make patterns as well. So for me to create a collection of 8 pieces, it's a lot.
Is it like just sketching and...
No, not just sketching, but final garments.
Wow.
Within 1 week. So I did anyway. So I thought about using anything that I could have imagined, like curtain fabrics and whatever is available at home, like cushion covers, and I just do a bit of mix and match and, you know, like put them together.
How did you put it together if you didn't know how to?
Stapler, okay. And some stitches. And I did borrow my friend's sewing machine, but it was really like a domestic one that it can hardly sew any thick fabrics. I mean, it will you know, all the threads will get stuck together and I have to repeat and do it again. So, but anyway, to cut the long story short, I managed to put together 6 pieces of stuff. I wouldn't even call it garments, but more like, well, you can still put on, but it's not like obvious that you can find a sleeve or a neckline, nothing like that. But it didn't really matter because to them, they just want to see your thinking process.
Yeah.
How you came up with those stuffs. And the next thing I knew was that I got accepted. No, 2 weeks later, I got the acceptance letter. So meaning I did something right, maybe, during the...
And that was to officially be in the school?
Or? Yes. Yeah. Yes. To enter the first year.
And then did you benefit a lot from going to Central St. Martin's, do you think?
To be honest with you, I didn't really have a lot of expectation because I just didn't know what it was like to study overseas, first of all. But then I think the special thing about the college is not really about the teachers, but really it was the environment that they created for the students.
Yep.
It was very competitive. People were all trying to do their own thing and all very secretive as well. They tried to cover up their work after schools, and you actually don't get to see them until the final presentation because they all try to present their masterpiece. You know, everyone was thinking that what they were doing is the best of the best, which was true because they're already in the best art and design college in the world. So the people that they have selected are kind of the creme de la creme to what's available. But for me, I was trying to take a more humble approach. As an Asian student, we are not used to being so proud, expressive and proud about our, and also because of the language barrier as well, right? I mean, we're not able to present it as well as the other native students. So for us, it was, I mean, the research part to talk about, I mean, the storytelling part was always a little bit difficult. So I knew that would be my obstacle. So I focused more on the actual work itself instead of telling too much about the inspiration, the stories.
I find that with my photography as well. Sometimes I'm not good at explaining it. Yep. I kind of like, I know what happened.
Let it speak.
For itself. And then did you graduate? Like how old were you?
Well, I guess it was 2003 or 2004. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what age were you?
21.
21. Okay.
And you can kind of guess how old I am. Okay.
And then from there, what did you do? Did you know exactly where to go?
No, I've no idea at all. And when I graduated from school, I was thinking, okay, now I got the best certificate for fashion. I mean, qualification in the fashion world. But what could I do with it? I really had no idea. And I sent out many applications at first and no feedbacks. And I was, at some points, I was kind of hopeless.
So were these applications to maybe work for a different brand or?
Yes, I tried all that, like internship experience in Paris couture house and British designers, even jewelry designers, whatever I could find on the newspaper, I sent my application. But there was only one that came back. It was a menswear design company. So the company has a multi-label store in London at the street called South Moulton Street, which is very close to Selfridges, a department store. I had no choice, literally, so I just go with whatever I was given. So when there, it was very multitasking. I had to be, you know, sales assistant, I mean, to sell the design as well as the design in the studio. So it's like an all in one position. But for me, it didn't really matter as long as I was hired.
Yeah. And were you hired or were you interning?
I was hired. So my first project that I did for them was a customization project. So this company has a lot of inventory from the past season. So they have a massive warehouse somewhere near the store. So I went in, they said, feel free to pick whatever you want. So I see a pile of jeans, denim jackets, t-shirts, whatever. Pick whatever you need and try to redesign it for us. So I was thinking, well, it's pretty much like what I did in school in St. Martin's, right? I was happy to do it. So I took about 30 to 40 pieces home, cut them up, we sold them together, and then put it in the store and see if they can sell.
Yeah.
And
as one-off pieces.
Yes, one-off pieces. And of course, the markup is crazy. I couldn't believe when I saw the price after the changeover. And funny enough, 2 weeks after, a British footballer, actually not British, but European footballer came in called Freddie Nomba. It was, which team I forgot, but it was one of the top footballers in the UK. And you know how much money these people make, right? So he bought a few pieces and one of them happened to be mine. And he wore it for a Calvin Klein advertising campaign ceremony. Okay. He was the camping model for the underwear photo shoot.
Okay.
And I couldn't believe it. Wow. The next day when I saw it on newspaper, the design was worn by him. So I was thinking, oh, okay, maybe I've done something right. So I keep on doing the same thing again and again. And then 6 months later, the design was featured in Sex and the City.
Oh, wow.
By Kim Cattrall. Yes. Wow. So it was a customized jeans.
Oh, wow.
For the stylist called, it was picked up by a stylist of Kim Cattrall. They call it Samantha. The character in Sex and the City is Samantha. And she was wearing the jeans, the customized jeans. It was embroidered with diamond like crystals and covered by a piece of vintage mesh fabric. Mm-hmm. She was wearing it on in the scene where she was shaving her hair because she was going into a chemotherapy.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that was the iconic one.
Then. Oh, okay.
And that was like, I was thrilled because I would never thought that I would have that opportunity as a fresh graduate. And I stayed there in that company for about 2 years before I returned to Hong Kong.
Okay. Before you returned where,
Hong Kong.
Oh, to Hong Kong. And then you worked at Hugo Boss. Was that your next adventure?
Yeah, so because my family is here in Hong Kong. Despite that, I did want to stay on in London to explore my fashion career, but then I feel that at some point I will have to come back to Hong Kong to be closer to my parents because Asians are very family oriented, as you know. So I did, but after I returned to Hong Kong, I actually had no idea what I could do. Certainly, I don't want to be a fashion designer in Hong Kong because I know what it will be, what it will turn out to be is mostly you'll be working for factories or agents to create.
Because that's the market. That's
the market.
The money is.
Like trading company to produce like 1,000 designs per day.
Yeah.
And that's not what I want.
Yeah.
So, and I was, you know, finding jobs in newspapers, and I came up with a job title called visual merchandising, which to me was very new.
Mm.
I didn't know exactly what it was, but I read the description. It was like exhibition, design, showroom, setup, and you know, styling, window displays, all this. It fits my criteria, yeah. And it's something that I know how to do. And that company is Hugo Boss.
Mm.
So I went in for an interview, and I got the job. Yeah. So I didn't know what to expect, but I knew
that was here in Hong Kong. The interview.
It was here in Hong Kong. Cool. The regional head was from Malaysia, lady actually, whom I still keep in touch with. I would call her my mentor.
Yeah.
So she basically told me everything I need to know about a fashion company.
Yeah.
And I looked up to her. And the next thing I know was that she was telling me that be prepared, that you'll be traveling extensively. Like probably you won't be able to come home during holidays, and you'll be traveling all the time.
Mm.
And it was true.
Yeah.
In that couple of years, I think half of my time was spent abroad.
In Germany?
Germany, all the markets that I had to look after, mainly Asia.
Okay.
And Paris, London, whenever they have a fashion show, I would have to go.
So where did you live? Was it just...
I would say that I was based here in Hong Kong, but yeah. I was always on the road. I was
you just
living
stay in hotels and...
Hotels.
Does the company pay for your living?
They pay for everything. I mean, that was, to me, a fresh graduate was like a luxury, right?
Yeah.
We were able to... I remember the criteria for picking a hotel is the closest to the place you have to work.
Yeah.
So sometimes it turned out, usually, next to the fashion show venue, it would be a five-star hotel instead of, you know, like a motel, right?
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
And that was great because as a fresh graduate, you got to stay at all the best hotels in the world.
Mm.
That's part of the job. Of course, you still have to work. Sometimes you only, you know, spend a few hours in a hotel, and then you have to wake up in the morning and go and work on the fashion show or something. So, but I didn't know such a job exists, you know, that you have to travel around the world and look, you know, take care of the windows and, you know, do model casting. That to me was very exciting.
So as a visual merchandiser, you were taking care of you know, the window display, the interior,
The seasonal presentation setup.
Yeah.
The props and the decorations of the venue.
Yeah.
Of course, to design the direction of the for the window displays for Asia and all around the world for the next 6 months. We used to have a booklet. It's still it's a printed booklet telling you what to do every month.
Yep.
And this is like a Bible for us. We have to go out there and train all the local visual merchandisers. So I would consider my job more as a trainer back then. I mean, of course, we have to work on creative, like how to set up like a model set that we can replicate around the world. And after that, after the creative process, the next step is to go out there and tell people how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why I was always traveling.
As a visual merchandiser, we also taking care of the casting as well, or is that another?
We were always involved in fashion events and fashion shows, and because visual merchandising is part of marketing in the organization, so there are a lot of shared responsibility, and the PR department would sometimes involve you in the casting of models for a local version or regional version of the global fashion show. I mean, global fashion events is something that a luxury brand would do once or twice a year. They pick the location. It could be sometime in Paris, New York, or even India,
mm-hmm.
or Hong Kong. And then, but other than the big scale event, you still have to do smaller events in the region or in specific markets. So our role was to talk to the headquarters to come up with a concept that we can replicate in other markets. And for the local events, for the Asian events, we would have to cast our own models as well, because we certainly don't have the budget to fly the original cast from Europe. But the good thing is every market now has its own model agents,
mm-hmm.
so we can find substitutes
okay.
that carries the same characters and style and do it locally.
So you would connect with local model agencies and cast
in for each market, like for Thailand, you have the local model agents there as well as PR agents, stuff like that.
Okay.
I mean, Hong Kong is the same case.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then, you worked your way up in Hugo Boss. Is that where you were?
Yeah. As I was telling you, I didn't know what to expect. So, visual merchandising was a starting point for me to get to understand the whole organization of a fashion or luxury company, and I realized that all the creative works are mainly under the marketing and creative service side, which is...
So marketing's like the top.
So it depends for... It's slightly vary for each company, but let's say a luxury brand, they usually have finance, sales, marketing, an operation. So the four main functions, and of course in the headquarters you will have creative service and product development as well, but that is not under the regional office scope. So for regional office like Asia, for example, we usually have four main areas, and marketing is the area where it is closer to creativity, where all the where all the creative campaigns are channeled, and visual merchandising, for example, is under marketing. Well, so I find that more relevant to me. So, and while I was working as a visual merchandiser, I was exploring what other areas I could do as well. So, and I was so lucky to be given another opportunity to work on it. Just tap into the area of marketing, advertising, PR, and even social media and CRM later on. So I stayed in Hugo Boss for about 7 years, but I was lucky enough to be able to, experience every single role within the marketing by the time I left.
Which was your favorite role and why at Hugo Boss?
I like it all, actually. I like them all.
You just like the creative decision making? Or what do you enjoy most about?
When I was given a new job, I would not divide which areas are creative and which are not. So basically you just do whatever you could to make the best outcome, to create the best result, right? So for me it's about learning something new rather than to say, oh, this is not the creative stuff that I enjoy doing, so therefore I don't do. So basically you just have to learn to be good at it. To me that it's also a creative process, because the learning process itself is a creative process. So, but if you ask me what I enjoy most is within the the marketing scope, I would say, is the PR and marketing, after all, because you will have opportunity to organize big scale event like a 600 people fashion show in a location that you think is right for the collection.
Yeah.
Let's say if you
were these shows based in Hong Kong or all over the world?
It can be all over the world, but for me, I could talk to I can if I have a very good concept in mind to present to the headquarters, if I say, oh, because I see that the current collection has a connection with some Indian embroidery elements. Mm. Therefore, I think it will be very impactful if we host a fashion show in Mumbai, where there are a lot of potential customers for embroidery.
So, as a PR representative for a company, it's, would you say it's very important to understand different cultures where you were understanding the culture?
First is the brand. You have to understand the brand that you work on, work for, and communicate a lot with the creative directors to understand his visions and the inspiration behind his design or her design. And then next thing is how to translate his vision into different markets, because each market has its unique culture.
Mm-hmm.
Like in Hong Kong, I'm sure, for Australia markets as well. Distinctive difference is the weather, right? For example, I know that in Australia, your winter is our summer.
Mm-hmm.
So we are kind of working in a reverse order.
Yeah.
But then for luxury brands, the direction tends to follow the European weather.
Yeah.
You know, when they showcase a fashion show, it would usually be based on the weather of the majority, right? So in their case, if it is a French brand, it will be the weather in France, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But when we have to roll the collection out in the market, it may not be the case, because for Australian market, it could be 6 months after.
Mm-hmm.
So then these are details that we have to consider when it comes to hosting fashion events and loaning samples to the media. You know, setting priorities are the key.
Okay, so yeah, it's not only the culture, it's the weather and like
the people,
maybe
the taste,
people, taste and the politics of the country as well.
Yes,
maybe.
Price points.
Yeah, because it's, say Hugo Boss, for example, and they're trying to sell their new suit collection. You'd be marketing that same suit. You wouldn't be changing the suit to fit the culture, but you're changing the marketing around that suit to sell in a specific country.
And you'll be surprised to know that in some markets we don't sell suits at all.
Really?
But we maintain the image as a suit brand.
Mm.
But then eventually you could be selling polos or shorts or jeans.
Well, something that's happened recently with I've seen a lot of change in the Hugo Boss branding, like a lot of change. I think they have more women representatives in the brand. Hailey Bieber, they've changed I think they changed it from Hugo Boss to Boss, I believe. What are your thoughts on the new changes?
It's exciting, I think. I already left the company for so long, so I can't really comment so much on their strategy and internal decision, but as a appreciator of fashion, I would say, well, any change is better than no change at all in fashion, because fashion itself is about change, season.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what makes it exciting in a way. I know that the company is going through some changes internally. For example, They've recently appointed a CEO from PVH Group, which is the owner of Calvin Klein and Tommy Hilfiger. The company is very fond of the whole social media and celebrity culture.
Yeah.
So, and I think that's one of the few things that the CEO brought over to Hugo Boss when he joined. And I definitely see more and more celebrity engagement with their current collections right now. And they're shipping their bricks and mortar retails to more buy now, see now approach online.
Yeah.
So they're focusing on a few iconic designs and try to make it like the key focus and have celebrities wearing them, endorsing them, influencers. And that's an interesting strategy, I mean, for marketing as well. Yeah.
Do you think, or just from talking to, say, one of my previous guests, Dreyfus, he was also a graphic designer at Central St. Martin's, and he was he graduated on the shift when kind of the internet came into play. As a designer, that was like a huge shift. And now social media is a part of all of our lives. Do you think social media was one of the biggest shifts in the fashion world as well, how you present things and market things that you've experienced?
It was a big transition for not just for fashion, for everything, basically. I still remember when I was responsible for advertising at Hugo Boss. The publications used to give online coverage as bonus on top of the print. So you buy two pages on their print magazines and they give you online coverage for free.
Okay.
So it was not the mainstream. I mean, it was not. In the beginning, it was not anything worth investing.
It was like secondary to print.
It was secondary. Yeah. It was more like a freebie for the advertisers. And look at now, it's the other way around. No one actually invests in print anymore. Mm. But I still do see the value of prints. You know, I mean, to me, the hand feels and even the smells and the quality of the pictures are different.
So, even if something is shown in a magazine, it's still, I feel like people still value it more.
Yeah.
Like if there's a feature in a magazine, wow, or in the newspaper even, like, wow, I'm featured in print, it like means something, whereas online is still very, it's very fast-paced, but print.
Yes, and prints are, to me, are collectibles. You know, something that you would want to keep. Mm. If you see something nice, you can either tear out the page and keep it somewhere as a research, or you keep it in your bookshelf. It serves a different purpose. It has a physical touch. Whereas for social media, it's information, but it doesn't last long. I mean, that's why, to me, it's getting harder and harder for creatives to make a lasting impression on people, because we just have so much information on a daily basis.
Yeah. Changing trends and...
Yes.
My perspective or my thinking behind print has changed because I was, I did collect magazines like as a young creative as well. But then when social media came, I was like, oh, okay, print is dead. It's all about the social media, because you can see in real time what kind of impact your marketing's making. You can see the numbers and the data. But now I'm thinking, because I collect kind of like photo books and I've collected a few magazines. And I'm thinking, when you have a magazine, it stays on your coffee table for like years and years, and you're going back and looking at it all the time. So I think there's still like a lot of value in print.
Yes. So I guess magazines would have to, in order for magazines and books to survive, they need to think differently. I think probably they have to think more to how to create a long-lasting, you know, like a beautiful
hardcover, yeah,
so people can keep.
Yeah.
Even when the issue is no longer relevant, I mean, they can still keep it.
Like a collectible item.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. And going back to kind of your journey, I think Jimmy Choo is kind of like is a very well-known worldwide brand. I don't know too much about it. I know they do women's handbags. Do they also do
high heel shoes? Mainly for shoes, actually.
Known for shoes, okay.
The reason why I went to Jimmy Choo was because I've been working in menswear for too long, and I study women's wear when I was in Central St. Martin.
Okay.
So being able to work on women's wear has always been my route and my dream. Yeah? I mean, I'm not saying that menswear is not interesting. Menswear could be equally interesting too, but it's kind of presented in a more subtle form, you know. Men are talking about tailor jacket, how to make the best tailor jacket with, you know, attention to details. But women's wear has a lot of things that you can play around, like silhouette, you know, draping, beading. Yes, make it a little bit more fancy. So when I was at Hugo Boss, I always wanted to tap into women's wear, although Hugo Boss did have, I think they still do have women's wear, but it was not like the extravagant
like style. Wear?
Yeah, business wear. More like similar to men's wear, like selling suits and blouses, but nothing like evening gowns or dresses. So I was telling myself, if there was the next opportunity for me, I don't care what it is, as long as it's women's wear, I'll go for it.
Okay,
and then it happened that my next employer, my next recruiter, was Jimmy Choo.
And
although
you were doing dresses at Jimmy Choo, or just the women's shoes, or
everything. So
everything.
They don't have clothes; they only have shoes and accessories.
Okay. Okay.
So it's actually a British brand started by a Malaysian guy called Jimmy Choo.
Yeah.
And he worked very closely with his co-founder, a British lady, English lady called Tamara Mellon, who's still a successful entrepreneur and managed to, you know, scale the company up and eventually sold it to another big luxury group.
Mm-hmm.
And when the time I joined the company, it was during the acquisition period from Jimmy Choo to a global, you know, mega luxury brand.
Oh, okay.
So I was witnessing, you know, from only a few stores and suddenly opening like 50 stores in Asia. So that was exciting.
Okay, wow. And were you the head of marketing for Jimmy Choo? Okay. And so you weren't like were you influencing the design of the shoes and the products? Because that's what you said you were interested in.
Yes. With Jimmy Choo, it was not so much with the design, but we did make a lot of, suggested a lot of collaborations with a tailor-made design for influencers and celebrities in Asia. So I remember I had a chance to travel with a celebrity from Taiwan, who is very famous across greater China regions. Her name is Su Qi.
Mm.
So I went with her to Milan, and to meet with the creative directors. There were two directors back then, or Jimmy Choo, to come up with a Cinderella shoe for this celebrity.
Okay, so is it her own sort of collection under Jimmy Choo? Or?
It was, at first it was only a unique piece for her.
Yeah.
But eventually it went into production, and then there was a capsule collection.
Okay.
Based on that,
that style, you know, okay.
Like, for her as the muse of the collections. Yeah. Yeah. So we went to Milan several times to talk about the design, to choose the fabrics, and you know, look at the sketches and modifications. So that was interesting.
So for you're me, kind of advising, you're like communicating with the creative directors.
Yes.
And like, so you are still a part of the process.
Yes, for a special project like that, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and another one I have is Moschino.
Oh yeah, Moschino, it was a brand distributed by a company I work for called Bluebell.
Mm.
Bluebell is a luxury brand distributors based in Asia.
Okay.
So they have shops in Japan, Korea, Hong Kong.
But it's
Taiwan.
it's not a Bluebell store, is it? Or is it it's a Bluebell store and they sell these luxury brands?
It's
or?
Distributor. It's like you can consider it as a marketer.
Yeah.
To open stores for these brands in Asia. Mm-hmm. So I was responsible for Moschino,
mm-hmm.
for Greater China region, and it was very interesting because back then they hired a new creative director to look after the apparel and, mm-hmm. and accessory for Moschino, and his name is Jeremy Scott.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, American designer, and of course he brought in a lot of American pop art influence to the collection as well. So it was an interesting hybrid of European high fashion and American pop art culture.
Mm.
So the first, I still remember the first fashion show we did was based on graphics from McDonald's.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
So it was.
And also just quickly, what would you consider American high fashion?
It was, I was not saying American high fashion, I was saying American pop art culture.
Oh, okay,
yes,
okay.
Yes, yes. So, to me, high fashion doesn't really, it's not coming from America. I mean, the consumers are from America. A lot of high fashion consumers are from America, but it didn't come from America.
Yeah.
But of course, you can still find luxury brands from America, like Ralph Lauren and Donna Karan.
Mm-hmm.
So these are high-end fashion brands from America.
Yeah.
But the roots of high fashion is actually more from Europe.
Okay.
Yeah, London, Paris, Milan. So contrast between the American pop art and the Italian high fashion was very utterly interesting to me.
So that particular collection that was inspired by McDonald's,
and there was, I still remember, there was, he was the one started the see now buy now trend with his first design to iPhone case with McDonald's French fries patting.
Okay. Which brand was that under?
Moschino.
Oh, Moschino.
Moschino.
Okay. Yeah, Moschino is, I've noticed they're very fun with their projects.
Yeah.
Have they always been sort of influenced by that pop art culture, that pop art?
Not really. It's known for producing quirkiness. No, like really,
that stands out.
Yeah, like avant-garde design.
Mm.
The colors always vivid. You know,
so would you say it's like the pop art brand of fashion? Almost?
I would say yeah.
Yeah,
kind of like that. So it's proven to be very hugely successful,
mm.
and we start to see a lot of younger customers coming to buy the pieces as well. Whereas before the joining of Jeremy Scott, it was more mature customers.
Mm.
And suddenly you see a drastic switch from, you know, like one demographic to another, which was very interesting.
And how did your role tie in with the creative directors of the brand? Because previously I was thinking like the creative director is the decision maker.
Yeah.
But obviously they have to tie in with like what the marketing department says and maybe your knowledge of like the culture. And
well, I guess the designers nowadays are quite different from the designers in the past. I think a lot of them actually, they do listen to a lot of feedbacks given from different markets. Some of the designers we know are very much about their own vision, right? I mean, they don't really care much about feedback, so they just do whatever they want.
Is that that's now?
No, this is not now.
Oh, that's previously. Okay.
Yeah, previously.
And now it's their influence.
Now I think it's a better balance, I would say. I mean, they would ask for feedback and what works and what doesn't. And then they will try to make changes for the next collections. Of course, they will still have to stay true to their vision, mm-hmm. but then they can make small, you know, like modification, alterations without changing the essence of the brand.
What I've seen recently that I think is interesting in the fashion world is big sort of brands like Uniqlo, for example, getting designers. Like there was a recent Marni collection and they get kind of niche but well-known designers to design a collection for, like a brand like Uniqlo, which sells kind of staple pieces for the mass public. Have you seen that sort of thing happen before?
Yeah, it's very common these days to have collaborations between, you know, different creators, different brands. Like a high street fashion can collaborate with
like the Yoji, Yamamoto and Adidas.
To make it more accessible, it's a win-win situation actually, because a lot of people see designers' labels very up there and they find it they find it not affordable. For some people, they could never own a piece from them. So by having this platform, like the high street fashion platform, they are able to, you know, let more people to enjoy their works. I think it's a win-win.
I think it's perfect.
Yeah, it's perfect, yeah.
And say, maybe like 20 years ago, was there still things like that happening? Like it's a more recent.
It's more recent. It is only started for about in the last 10 years, I would say.
Oh, that's interesting, because I think, these high-end brands have had to become more accessible.
Yes, that's right.
Why do you think that has had to happen? Is it to do with...
As I said, in the past, the creative directors and designers are very, you know, protective about their own image, right? They wouldn't want to let other brands share the voices. But then we are in a time where we are treasuring collaborative cultures.
Yeah.
And that's how the way we create new things, right? I mean, if you're always working on the same idea again and again, you're kind of running out of juice, right?
Mm.
So after a few brands tried and succeeded in the collaborations, more brands are trying to follow because they see it as a great way to create a movement and newer designs and energy. So I guess this is how it all started at first.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, and then when did you start your personal company?
Yes. I must say, I'm a really practical person. As I know, as I told you in the beginning, that I knew being a fashion designer in Hong Kong may not be something that I want to pursue.
Yeah.
Long run, but I do want to start my own brand.
Okunro, is it?
Yes. So after years of gathering experience and a bit of investment, I can finally start my own business about 7 years ago. But I didn't.
It's quite recent then, in a way.
It's quite recent. Because I was not ready maybe before that. So
what made you kind of get to that point where you wanted to start your own
age?
Okay.
Yes, I knew that. I was too comfortable.
I mean, you can. It doesn't matter what age you are, if you're a PR or creative director or whatever. Is it?
Like, no, it's. I was.
Or you just personally wanted to move on to something else?
I always set myself goals from time to time. And at the end, I realized that I've kind of fulfilled many goals that I've set out to do. And at a point, I was so comfortable in living the lifestyle that I had. And I knew that if I don't step out of my comfort zone, I would never do it after a certain age because there are more risks to be taken.
Yeah.
And it's not, you're not only thinking about yourself, but other responsibilities as well. Maybe you have a mortgage to look after, think about your retirement. So the older you get, the more burdens.
Tying you down sort of thing.
So I know I told myself 35 years old was the was the age.
That's young.
35 is, if I want to start, I have to start before 30. I turned 35.
Okay.
Because I knew after 35 I'd probably prefer something a little bit more stable. And more realistic in a way. So I did it. So it was tough actually to start to begin with, because I would call it a startup. So basically, you had to do everything by yourself, from sales pitching, product development, marketing, PR, communication, and even finance, accounting.
Mm.
From day one, it was me and my two partners. So, but I was picking every partners very carefully. So I had one who looks after finance, I know, which I was not keen to do. Not that I couldn't do it, but I know it's not my area of expertise. The other one was from product development. It's actually my classmate from St. Martin.
Okay.
Yeah, who has a very strong manufacturing background, which I know we would benefit the product development side.
And did you patent the, because the unique thing about the luggage company is like the curved shapes and that sort of thing. Was that something you patented early on, or did you have that idea already in the back of your mind and then start the company, or did you start with basic luggage and then refine the design?
Okay, I think the first thing that came up to my mind was to, I knew that I want to reinvent the traditional business.
Yeah.
And I knew that fashion was too competitive because pretty much everything people have already done. So I was looking at other sectors that are more ordinary.
Mm-hmm.
So happened that, and I got to travel quite a lot, right? So I see a lot of luggage, boring luggage when I was traveling. So I was thinking, oh, maybe this is the area I could do. And it's more difficult to copy in a way, right? Because it requires a massive machine to produce luggage, right? Yeah. Whereas clothes, if you have a sewing machine at home, you can do it.
Just do it,
So that's how.
And how did you come up with the concept of the round luggage? Because I'm just thinking, was it, because I'm thinking in the compartment above the seats, it is kind of like a cylindrical shape. So is that how you can like put it in lengthways, and you thought of it like that? Or?
Well, if you're already thinking that way, you're not my customer. No, the reason why I came up with a round shape was I didn't want to do something that everybody is doing. And I explore many other shapes as well.
Triangle.
But triangle, yeah. But even is the least practical option, maybe, right? But I wouldn't say no. I mean, never say never. Maybe one day I'll do a triangular one.
I'm gonna patent that.
Yeah, but actually it was inspired from Hatbox. So the design already exists, but it was not a rolling luggage. It was, I think back in the Victorian period, people used to carry hat to travel with, right? So there's round case, but not planned for long haul travels or to put their clothes in, but more for hats. So I have a habit to visit antique markets. So I always go for treasure hunts and look for secondhand objects. And I found this hat box that I was inspired by. I was thinking, can I make it more relevant to the modern travel? You know, like so that people can carry this beautiful design with them.
Do you think the round shape is more practical or more fashion?
I can tell. Well, actually, a lot of my customers, a lot of existing users were telling me that it can contain more than a rectangular.
Okay.
So, but this is a bit of both. Well, I would say it's more or less the same.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Of course, we have done a lot of prototypes to make sure that it can fit as much as possible. So we went to, I think, 30 factories to try to get them to produce the design for us, but only one.
So you're meeting with these factories within like mainland China?
Yeah. Yep. Because only mainland China's have the facilities and the scale to produce luggage. In Hong Kong,
yeah,
there's no way you can find a factory who can house such a big machine. Right? So we went to 30 factories, but only one set they could try to develop.
The round.
Yeah. So that was tough because angular shape, right? Yeah. You see one metal strip like this, you have to bend it four times to create the frame of the luggage. But for a round luggage, you need to bend every single second in order to create that shape.
Yeah.
And literally there was no machine
that does that
back then. So they had to develop a new mold.
Yeah.
So, but you just, I guess we already have 1 foot in, so we had to go with at least get the first design realized.
They literally developed a whole new machine for the shape.
Yes. So that was a huge investment, and I managed to get my previous employer to invest in the project, which I consider myself very lucky. Without having to invest everything by myself, but it took around 6 to 8 months to produce the prototype. And I still remember at first we didn't have the final product to sell, so we only had like 20 imperfect prototypes to show to the buyers and media. And we did a press day in Hong Kong. We managed to get a small budget to invite like about 50 people, key people from department stores.
So you got the budget from investors?
Investors, as well as from our own.
Mm-hmm.
We invite key customers, not customers, buyers from department stores, wholesalers, and media to come and have a look.
This is like a fashion show for luggage?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. It was a big success. We got a lot of local articles. Of course, as you can imagine, if you host an event in Hong Kong, you only get coverage from Hong Kong media, right? But with the help of social media, it kind of, you know, had a bit of a word of mouth effect. Yeah, yeah?
Especially I think in Hong Kong, like, it's kind of a smaller city, everybody knows everybody, so it's easy to get people to talk about your product, especially around a piece of luggage.
Yeah,
that's a good talking point.
Right, so people recognize it after a while, and we received orders. But now the tricky part was to produce, because the quality control is the toughest when it comes to luggage.
Mm.
Especially we're developing a new shape.
Did you get these buyers to pre-order the luggage?
Okay. We did. We got like a good 200, 300 pieces order at first.
Okay.
But not enough for...
Were they just samples for these stores or...?
Individuals.
Individuals.
And some are from Seoul.
Okay.
But then the quantity was not enough to fulfill the minimum order, the MOQ. So we have to place a bet whether we want to top up, order that minimum orders, deliver the first orders, and remaining we try to sell as many as possible.
Mm.
And of course we went that, I went for that options. Yeah. So it was difficult. There was like many nights that I spent in the factory, in, you know, instructing them how to do things and, you know, attention to details and make sure the line.
Were you living in like near the factory at the time?
I was very harsh because, you know, people who worked in the factory finished at 6 sharp at night. Every minute of overtime they would have to charge more, right?
Mm.
So I have to make sure that they finish as much as possible within the working hours.
So it was only 200 pieces that were being made?
1,000, the minimum quantity.
1,000.
So roughly the first order we got was about 300 pieces.
Yeah.
But we had 700 pieces in inventory that we had to sell.
Okay.
So the pressure that we have, for me and my partners, were huge. So, but for all startups, in the beginning, it's always the hardest. The three of us sit in the office sometimes, got nothing to do because we don't receive the we don't receive orders, and trying to sell more. But how? You know, when you don't have the contacts and the right people to talk to, it's very tough. And we certainly can't spend time designing the next one because we need the capital to reinvest in the next design. So that was, there were
stressful.
A lot of arguments and say, are you doing the right things? You know, like, but luckily, the next big hit was a retailer in Hong Kong called Kapok, a French gentleman who owns several multi-label stores in Hong Kong, came and bought several, you know, like a decent amount from us. And from there, we got a lot of referral customers and started to spread the words to other people. And then later on, we got Link Profit and some other bigger department stores in Hong Kong and also in Asia. But then the turning point for us was actually from Grace, our mutual contact. She came to one of my product presentations, and because of her social media influence, one of the buyers from Net-a-Porter was aware of our design.
Okay.
And of course, Grace managed to help us to, you know, do the communications and help us a little bit to make the selling a little bit easier. And it was the first big order we secured. And we sold...
It was with Net-a-Porter.
It was Net-a-Porter. We sold them to UK, America, and Asia.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. And that was... And there were a few repeated orders on top afterwards. So we were over the moon, of course.
And was that just with the one design? You had just had one design?
With one design, okay. But we did a few exclusive designs on top, like small modifications of the existing design. And then it kind of, you know, like expanded from there. You know, we got retailer from Italy, France, America.
Wow.
And yeah, and then we kind of just move on from there. And then the media started to come to us, the international media like New York Times, British Folk, and
wow.
Monocle. So,
and then boom, hit.
Yeah, wow. And then we came up with, then that was when we could think about creating
a new design. Yeah. Okay. And also, have you worked with sustainability in fashion as well?
Yes.
So what have you been involved in?
So you know, last couple of years was tough for traveling business, like mm-hmm. travel related business because of COVID, right? Mm-hmm. People were not able to travel.
Oh yeah.
So I was taking my time slow to just figure out what I could do on the side, and a few friends refer me to a sustainable footwear brand.
Mm.
Whom they needed someone who can tell them how to expand overseas and with a bit of branding as well. So this is an Australian couple who has a manufactory in China.
Mm-hmm.
So they are making use of mushroom leather and apple skin to create sneakers, which are very interesting.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and also recycled bottles as well, plastic bottles. So I was helping them to secure retailers and, you know, finding influencers using the similar formula that I used for Wukong
mm-hmm.
when I launched my luggage, and try to help them to, you know, like to spread their message
mm-hmm.
to other markets as well.
Okay, interesting. So what were they making shoes out of? Sorry, was it?
Mushroom leather
and
apple skin. Yes.
How is that even possible? Like, to isn't that decomposed or
decomposed, but they can just really gather as many from the apple farm.
Yeah.
And then there's a chemistry, like, of course it's environmental friendly chemistry mm-hmm. that they can use to turn it into a sustainable material.
Okay.
I mean, if you get a hand feel of it, it actually feels like leather.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah. What are some of the advances that you've seen as someone who's been in the fashion industry, and with this, I think there's been a lot of influence and demand for more sustainable clothing items and that sort of thing. What are some of the more inventive ways of making fashion have you seen? Because I was just in Japan, and there's this brand called Slow Made Japan, and they, I think they get kind of discarded items and take out the threads and then remake the shirt and that sort of thing. So what have you seen that's kind of impressed you?
Well, to me, there are many different approaches to be sustainable. It doesn't mean that one person is only buying like recycle products are the best scenarios. I mean, you can, to me, my belief is to buy less, mm-hmm. but buy quality, mm-hmm. something that I can use for many years. Yeah. I mean, to me, buying a good pair of leather shoes that can last for 10 years is equally as good as buying a sustainable sneakers that I can only use for 1 year.
Mm.
You know, so to me, it's a conscious action, I mean, and thinking as well.
Just being conscious
being conscious about what you consume
mm-hmm.
and how you consume it. And yeah, to me, it's more important than, you know, making sure that everything that you use is sustainable, which is mm-hmm. impossible in the modern world. I mean, everything is changing so fast. And
okay. And during your working life, have you ever lived in another city for a long period of time? Because I know you said you were always based in Hong Kong, but did you ever like live in another
Shanghai?
City, like Shanghai?
I was, well, I think the one of the core, I wouldn't call it a core responsibility, but I think for people who work in luxury fashion, you have to expect to be travel extensively to communicate with your customers. So I was, in the past 20 years, I was always on the road, you know, meeting different people. To me, although I call myself based in Hong Kong, but I was never here. Yeah. I was always like, you know, every time when I go to, let's say Fashion Week, it's 3 weeks. So starting from London, Milan, Paris.
Mm-hmm.
So 3 weeks are gone. And there are some months that I'm hardly home. So, and I actually enjoy it this way because I still want to have a base, somewhere that I could call home. I feel like where I belong and I can still come back and recharge.
Yeah.
But then I could also live in other places where I have friends and, you know, enjoy the different cultures, which are amazing, I think.
So why do you still choose Hong Kong as your home?
Because my family. One very straightforward answer is my family is here. And it's my comfort zone. There are a lot of new territories that I can still tap into, but still I want this comfort zone for myself here. Yes, and it's connected to mainland China as well, which is the huge market for us.
Okay. And then lastly, if there was one piece of advice that you would give to kind of young creators who want to make a global impact, maybe work for big brands or create their own brand and or create works that's seen worldwide, what advice would you give them?
I would say don't underestimate any opportunity that you are given, because you never know what this one can lead you to at the end.
Mm-hmm.
So, but always have a vision of where you want to go. I think this is very important. And somehow I believe the universe will kind of shift things around. And if you work hard and lucky enough,
mm-hmm.
you might get to do what you want to do eventually, but start with this one. I think this is my advice. And I have always, you know, stick to this
mm-hmm.
for the last 20 years. And it helped out. I mean, it kind of, I managed to fulfill many goals that I set myself out to do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so.
Amazing. Anson, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's
welcome.
Great talking to you.
Yeah, a pleasure. Exchanging ideas.
Yeah. Where can people kind of contact you if they want to like contact you?
Email me,
yep.
Instagram. So, I mean, I can leave you the contact.
Okay, yeah. I'll